Afternoon, this meeting of the House Health and Social Services Committee will come to order. It is 3:08 p.m. on Thursday, April 5th in Capitol Room 106. Members present are Representative Vice Chair Zolkowski, Representative Johnston, and myself, Representative Sponholz. Let the record reflect that we do not have a quorum to conduct business, but we're not conducting any official business, so it doesn't really matter. Go ahead and silence your cell phones if you haven't already done that, just so we can have a smooth presentation. I want to thank, before we get too far into the business, Butch Carber, the House Health Secretary from Records, and Madison Truitt from the Juneau LIO for staffing the committee today. Today we have one item on the agenda. It's the presentation from KC Family Programs. I asked KC Family Programs to come to help us understand how Alaska's child welfare system compares with others across the nation and get an update on national laws that impact Alaska. And I guess I'll start by inviting Sue Robeson to come forward and put yourself on the record and then introduce your peers as they proceed. Thanks.
Thank you. Madam Chair and members of the committee, my name is Susan Robeson, R-O-B-I-S-O-N. I'm Director of State Relations and our Public Policy Unit at KC Family Programs. With me today are other members of our KC Family Programs team. We have Nikki LaPron with our Data Advocacy Unit. Lynn Biggs, who is strategic consultant for Alaska. Anita Findey, managing director of our Indian Child Welfare Program, and Thomas Cody, director of our Indian Child Welfare Program. First, I'll be introducing KC Family Programs very generally. And then we will be talking about state commissions and task forces for child welfare and foster care. An interest of this committee, as I understand. Then we will be talking about some of the outcomes, the data related to outcomes for children in the child welfare system nationally and in Alaska. Next, we will talk about KC Family Programs systems improvement work nationally and in Alaska. And our Indian child welfare work, as well as some federal funding opportunities. KC Family Programs is the nation's largest operating foundation that's focused on safely reducing the need for foster care and building communities of hope for children and families. Our mission is to provide, improve, and ultimately prevent the need for foster care. We have very clear goals for 2020 that we would like to reach by the year 2020, and those are to safely reduce the number of children in foster care by 50% with 2005 as the baseline for that goal. We also are focused on reinvesting the savings from a reduced use and unnecessary use of foster care into building stronger and more supportive communities, families, and systems. And in our work to improve child well-being, we focus on outcomes beyond child welfare in education, employment, mental health, and in the overall well-being of children, families, and their communities. KC Family Programs has agreements with all 50 states, the District of Columbia, Puerto Rico, and 16 tribes. Those agreements are focused on improving safety, child safety, permanency, and well-being. In all cases, we have agreements with the Public Child Welfare Agency in the jurisdiction, and often we have agreements and partnerships with other organizations within the state, sometimes the courts, the private providers in some cases, community organizations in many cases, advocacy organizations. It varies very much from state to state and jurisdiction to jurisdiction.
I'm going to just jump in here and recognize that Representative Sullivan Leonard joined us at about 12 minutes past 3. Go ahead.
Thank you. I want to also talk first about the use of state child welfare commissions and task forces. In your folders, you have a handout on some research on commissions and task forces that have been created by legislatures. In addition to these, often governors create commissions and task forces to examine child welfare, foster care. In some cases, the Supreme Court has created and led the convening of such groups or other judicial leaders. And also legislatures across the country sometimes create task forces or groups that legislators only participate in. But this handout really focuses on bodies that legislatures create for convening stakeholders and leaders from many different groups and organizations who often don't otherwise have an opportunity to share their perspectives and to study together the outcomes for children and families and the strategies, the barriers in the state, and to develop a plan together. So it is an approach that can be triggered by a specific concern or interest of policymakers and constituents, or can be a broad effort to study the child welfare system, the outcomes for children and families, and to work together to seek solutions and to develop recommendations. Often they include policy, practice, administrative recommendations, as well as a plan for monitoring the impact of their recommendations over time and the progress that the state makes. So that's a very high-level overview, and there are some examples in your packets of some recently developed commissions and task forces that legislators have created. Next, I am going to hand it off to my colleague from Data Advocacy. Casey Family Programs was created by Jim Casey, who was the founder of UPS and his family. And he was very committed to strong families. He found he created UPS as a very young man, and he was not part of the foster care system, didn't have experience with the foster care system, but saw in his life and in his work building UPS that employees who had strong families did better. And he was also very focused on outcomes. So one of the questions he would ask constantly of his company was, how are the deliveries? And he wanted numbers, he wanted to know how they were performing. And in 1966, he started Casey Family Programs, and when he would participate in board meetings and work with the foundation, the question he would always ask is, how are the children? And so we've really built on that, and data is a very big part of our work. We try to, in our public policy team, which I represent, we work with national, state, and local policymakers. We are nonpartisan. We provide information that's based on evidence and data, and our goal is to educate policymakers, be a resource for policymakers, in a nonpartisan format, and we rely very heavily on data. So we wanted to provide some data for you today about how children are doing in Alaska and compared to how they're doing nationally. So Nikki's going to take the handoff for now.
Thank you. Thank you, Susan. Thank you, Chairperson Sponholt and committee members. Long, big legs. As Susan said, my name is Nikki LaPron. I'm the Director of Data Advocacy, one of the units at Casey, and our focus is really to work with states and jurisdictions and to help them understand the data that they have on child welfare and what that data is telling them or could be telling them about the children in their programs. As Susan mentioned, we have agreements with all states, and part of that agreement is that states provide us, Casey, with their child welfare data at the same time that they send it to the federal government, which is twice each year. And we're able then to look at that data both for individual states and then across the states. I'm going to start with talking about and looking at the safety of children, because safety is the paramount importance and really what we're all concerned about, both safety of children before they come into the system and then safety of children once they're in the foster care system. In Alaska, unfortunately, the rates of child abuse and neglect reports, investigations, and substantiations are above the national average across all of that, so not doing, you know, doing worse than a number of states. In fiscal year 2016, which is the most recent data we have at this point, about 64 children per 1,000 children in the population were subject to a child abuse investigation. And this rate...
We have a question. Representative Sullivan Leonard.
If you don't mind, through the chair. I read through a few of the slides in here after this, but I'm just wondering, so you've highlighted our Alaska Native American children, and then you do a comparison with the white youth, but certainly we have African American mm-hmm. children, and we've got Samoan and Hmong and Lao and many, many others. Is that not a comparison that you've looked at, or kind of where does that go then on the scale, okay. both in Alaska and comparatively?
And through the chair, that's an excellent question. We do have that data. While I did not do those comparisons across all of the different groups, that's certainly something that we can look into more and get back to you on. Really focused with this presentation mostly on the comparison between the Alaska Native children and the white children. Those were the largest discrepancies in general. The data that we receive is separated into certain categories, and we don't have some of the real more fine-tuned categories, like as you were describing, Lao or Samoan. Generally those get kind of grouped more into broader categories. Sometimes it's an other category, sometimes it's a Asian, or, you know, we have a limit in terms of the data we get as to what the groupings are. So it is something that we could provide some more information later on about the different, how different ethnic, racial and ethnic groups that we have data on, how they fare across these different measures. I'd be happy to do that.
Sure. And just to follow up, Madam Chair, so really these are the highest numbers that you have at the top of your list, and is pretty much what you're telling me.
Correct.
And the others would be considered maybe in a group called the other, but it would be less than the statistics that you show here. I mean, significantly less.
Through the chair, I don't want to say that it would be necessarily be true across. I believe it would be, but I would want to actually pull the data and look to see. I believe that in everything I've looked at for the data, that the Alaska Native children, that racial ethnic category was, looking across the racial and ethnic categories, was always had the kind of highest numbers, worst numbers.
Okay. All right.
But I would want to actually go back and look at that.
Thank you.
We have a question from Representative Johnston.
Yes, thank you, through the chair. Could you define what screened in report is? Because I know that there's different categories. That's my first question. And then my follow-up question, as far as what qualifies as a Native American Indian youth, define that also.
Okay, great. Thank you, through the chair. So screened in is our reports that have come in for essentially being looked at in terms of whether or not there's going to be an investigation. It is different in every state, so I would not want to speak about how that actually is defined within the state of Alaska, because we're getting the data. There's the requirements in terms of what gets reported to the feds are set, and so there's certain categories that we get the data in, but in terms of each state, how it might differ about how that, what that process is, would be different in each state. One of the categories, race ethnic categories, that is in both the census and in the data that we get is American Indian, Alaska Native, and that's the category. We don't define that. That's how it comes to us.
I we are a melting pot, mm-hmm. and so I Thank you.
Mm-hmm. So to sort of to clarify that, is it possible that this is self-identification?
Yes, it could be self-identification. It could be identification by the worker who's getting the information and putting it into a, you know, all of this, all of the data starts with the case management system that the jurisdiction the state has. And so it's going to depend on how that information gets put in. Sometimes there's a lot of missing information initially, particularly say it's screening in and investigation and substantiation. Whoever is, you know, seeing the case may not know enough at that point what those categories are, and sometimes those get changed over time in terms of trying to be more correct. Ideally, it is self-identification or identification by what the parents are saying their child is, but it's I can't promise that it is like that in every instance.
All right, thank you.
All right. So again, as just kind of noted here on this slide, the investigation and screened in an investigation rates are higher for Alaska than in many other states, and there's huge, kind of the first place here that we see real discrepancies and differences, disparity between Native Alaskan American Indian youth and, in this case, white youth, a much lower rate, and these are rates per 1,000 in the population.
Representative Zelkowski has a question.
Do you have a sense of contributions for that disparity? Could it be the number of individuals that might be calling, or what contributes to such a significant increase in one population over the other?
Through the chair, I would say that there could be many reasons for that, and I really would not want to speculate on what it is. I mean, it could range from that there are some real differences, you know, real true differences, and some reporting differences, that some populations might be more likely to be reported or more in the public eye. So there could be lots of reasons, and I don't know enough about life in Alaska to really want to speculate on what that would be. This slide looks at the substantiation rate, which again is also high compared to the national average, the light gray line being the national average. Substantiation indicates that there has been a finding of maltreatment in terms of how, and that again, sort of how maltreatment is defined and substantiated can vary across different states, it's good to compare to what the national average is, it's also important to just sort of look at how a particular state has done across time. And we can see that in Alaska, the substantiation rate has really increased in the last several periods. And again, there is quite a difference between the substantiation rate for Alaska Native American Indian youth and white youth as the two comparisons. And again, these, I didn't note it here, but these are rates per 1,000 in the population. Maltreatment recurrence is defined as the percent of children involved in a substantiated incident of maltreatment who experience a second substantiated incident within 6 months. So you can see from the graphic on the top here, the first occurrence for many youth is not the last occurrence. About 13% of youth in Alaska who experience maltreatment are involved in a second incident of maltreatment within 6 months of the first. And that's nearly double the national rate, which is around 5%. While it's not noted on the slide, but there's also a difference then between for Native Alaskan youth and white youth. Native Alaskan youth experience repeat maltreatment at about 17%, and white youth at about 8%. Despite this high level of maltreatment and maltreatment reoccurrence, in Alaska, child maltreatment rarely results in fatalities. As you can see, again, from the bottom graph on the right, the pattern has been up and down, but it's nearly always been below the national average. This rate is done slightly differently. It's a rate, because fatalities, fortunately, are a fairly rare occurrence, this is a rate per 100,000 children. Nationally, the average is about 2.25 child fatalities per 100,000 children. For 2016, The federal data show only one fatality in Alaska, so it's less than 0.5. It's about 0.5 is how it works out per 100,000. But it's a very rare, fortunately, a very rare occurrence, child fatalities.
Representative Johnston?
Yes, through the chair. While the maltreatment recurrence is large, I do notice that it peaked in 2014, and it is dropping a little bit. And are you going to be covering that, or just
through the chair? I will not be covering it more than you see on the slide. I mean, I don't know the details about how that has changed in terms of what may have changed in practice or in other kinds of things. But you absolutely are right. It has been dropping, and it is. We should be getting the most recent data in the next 2 or 3 months, we're hoping. This particular set of data, there's two major data sets, and I'll probably botch the actual names because they do them by their initials. One is NCANS, the National Child Abuse and Neglect Data Set, and that's just a yearly data pull that happens. We should be getting that from states in the next couple of months, and so we'll be able to really look at 2017. 2016 feels a little far away at this point. And ideally, we will see that trend has continued for Alaska because it has gone down. Nationally, as you see, it's been very flat. And so for, you know, a state to even have any change at all is a good thing because it's been very flat nationally. As you know, and as we all know, that maltreatment often results in the child being removed from the family and placed in foster care. Alaska has one of the highest rates of entries into foster care, with about a little over seven children per 1,000 entering care in fiscal year 2017. What's not shown on this slide, but I do want to point out, is that rate has been decreasing over the last few years. And actually in 2016, Alaska was at about second or third from the top, and it's kind of dropping down, which is absolutely a good thing. Also noted here again, as we continue to see the disparity between Native Alaskan youth and white youth in terms of the rate of entry into care, again, per 1,000 children. The drop in an entry rate is always good news, and until recently, this slide kind of shows that there were more children entering care than exiting care. The dark orange line on the top is the number of entries, and the lighter orange line on the bottom is the number of exits. And you can see on the slide that for many years, that orange line was above and sometimes significantly above the lighter orange line. And it has been, in the last couple of years, beginning to trend down. The number of exits has certainly been moving up over the last several years, which is a good thing. And finally, at the end of that period, entries and exits line crossed, meaning that more children are leaving or young people are leaving care than coming into care, which certainly is a good thing, especially when you've had a very high rate. And it also then helps to decrease the actual number of children in care.
Representative Johnston?
Mm-hmm. I apologize. Thank you, through the chair. Do we have an idea of how much is this dependent on age, demographics?
Through the chair. Not offhand. In terms of age, I'm not sure if you're asking sort of is it older youth emancipating, is that the exits, or so the exit graph has always included, the exit line has always included children up through 24, which seems very old, but in some states their foster care, extended foster care can go for that long. So certainly some of it is that. I mean, children eventually exit the system, whether they age out or whether they achieve permanency. You know, children eventually do exit the child welfare system. We'd need to pull some data and look at it in more detail. But I would say that in general, our data perspective and kind of how we've looked at a lot of this data, even if it is, say, there's been suddenly a lot of children aging out, that tends to sort of even out over time. And so that's not, when you see something like this where there's really a change, we tend to make an assumption that it's more about something is happening in practice and that things are being done differently to improve this rather than, oh, we suddenly had a bunch of 18, 19, 20-year-olds who exited care.
Yeah. Just to follow up, I just know that we do have times when we have sort of population growth,
mm-hmm.
and so it'd be interesting to compare the two.
Mm-hmm.
I'll just follow up on that. There, as you mentioned, Representative Johnson, there can be variations, you know, in age of the foster care population, but there has also been pretty significant changes in practice in terms of commitment to permanency in our foster care system. Within just the last few years, there's been a growing understanding, I think in part due to advocacy by foster youth, that permanency is a priority over reunification. And there has actually been legislation and other practice changes that have come out as a result of that, and that is what I'm expect is the cause of that change.
Thank you. In this next slide, we can see in the bottom left that the actual number of children in care has begun to decrease, and that really is the part of that trend of the entries versus the exits. Since about the A and B periods are a point in time at the end of March of the fiscal year and the end of September. So 16A would be March 31st, 2016, September 30th, 2016. And you can see that it's very slight, but that the numbers have actually begun to decrease. The graph on the right shows the rate in care. So again, that's per 1,000 children in the population. So again, still high for Alaska, but I do think that as the numbers in care in Alaska are beginning to decrease, and that we see that change in that entry and exit pattern, one would expect that as we get new data in another month or so, because we've hit the March 31st, and we usually get new data somewhere around May or June, that ideally we'll see both the numbers continue to drop and perhaps the rate in care drop as well. The rate in care is, we often use that because that does take into account the increase or decrease in the size of the overall population. And if you have more children in the population, it's reasonable to expect there might be more children in care, but you would hope that the rate in care, the number per 1,000, does not increase as well. One area that Alaska is doing very well in, particularly compared to other jurisdictions, is in the use or the lack of use of congregate care. The graph on the right shows that nationally about 20% of the children are in a congregate care, and that would be a group home, an institution, a residential treatment facility, anything that is not a family home, a family setting. And again, nationally, that's about 20%. In Alaska, it's about 5%. So we look at that as being a very good thing. It's very hard for children when they're in congregate care to move to permanency because they're not used to living in a family home. They're used to living in a more group home setting. And it's, while sometimes those children that are more troubled, it's oftentimes also that it's just that's what the placement is. It's a group home, particularly for teenagers. And that's a very hard setting to get out of and to move into permanency from. We do see the graph on the right shows, in this case, it's Alaska Native American Indian compared to all other youth, not just to white youth, but to all other youth. We were able to look at it a little differently here. So we see the discrepancy, the difference between the two is not as much as it was on some of the earlier pieces. And likely just because there is such a low rate of use of congregate care. Certainly one of the most important things, besides safety for children, is permanency, is moving children out of foster care into permanent homes. And we can see that while Alaska's here, it's just there's not a graph, but we just have the note here, that Alaska has had a low but an improving rate of moving children to permanency within the first 12 months of entering care. These numbers are a bit older. It's fiscal year 15 because we need to allow first for that year that they could have come out of care, and then also there's some correcting that is done. Sometimes when children might be in a trial home placement, and then that becomes actually their reunification, and so those get essentially kind of backdated to when that trial home placement started. But you can see that Alaska, while it's below the national number of 39%, has been improving over time. If I were to have a slide of that, which I don't on this one. The other place around permanency that we look at too is for what we often refer to as long stays, children who've been in care two or more years. And oftentimes those permanencies might be adoption, which can be very slow for children. But nonetheless, we, again, don't want children to be in care forever. We want them to be able to move out of care. And for long stays in Alaska, for children who've been in care two or more years, Alaska is doing a better job than the national average in terms of moving those children to permanency. And while that sort of seems, I know sometimes when I'm showing a graph like this and people are like, well, of course that's what would, you know, happen. They've been in care a long time. They're moving. There are some states, you know, obviously it's an average, so there are a number of states that don't move those children to permanency either. Their kids kind of are in care. Once they're in care over 2 years, they're in care forever in some places, unfortunately. So that's, I mean, that's an area that it seems like Alaska's doing very well in. And a final measure that we really try and keep an eye on is reentry into care. Certainly we want children to go home or to exit foster care, but we want that to happen safely and not have children move in and out, in and out, in and out of the system. And in Alaska, that has been a very low reentry rate. It goes up and down, as you see there, but they have always been one of the lowest rates of reentry. So when children are exiting, they are, and then this is really looking at the timely permanence, too. So when children are exiting within that 12 months, very few of them are coming back in the next 12 months. And so, you know, obviously that's a good thing. Children are going home and they're being able to be kept safely at home. And I say going home because generally when it's within that first 12 months, it is reunification or sometimes some type of guardianship sometimes. But those are generally how children are moving out of care within the first 12 months. And I believe, yes. So I am going to turn this over to my colleague, Lynn Biggs, who is going to talk to you more about some of the work in Alaska and strategic consulting.
Thank you, Representative Sponholz and committee, for this opportunity to talk with you. My name is Lynn Biggs, and I've been with Casey Family Programs for 29 years now. And what I do is I have a field office in Yakima, Washington, because we provide direct service. And we have 9 offices in 5 states, Casey Family Programs. And then we also have an Indian Child Welfare office in Denver. And my colleagues, Anita Findey and Thomas Cody, will talk with you more about that. And then another part of our work that I will talk more about today is systems improvement work. And what that means is that Casey Family Programs, with our vision of providing, improving, and ultimately trying to prevent the need for foster care, wants to really join with states and try to see what we can do together to improve the outcomes for children. And we do so with a 50-state strategy so that we have folks like myself, strategic consultants in every state plus Puerto Rico. And what we do is work with our state partners, look at data, look at what your hopes are to improve your system in foster care, and come alongside and join those efforts, support those efforts. And that's what my pleasure has been the last 8 years to do in the state of Alaska. So I work quite a bit with the Office of Children's Services, and I also work with a lot of the tribes and certainly in partnership with my Indian Child Welfare colleagues. So that's kind of, in a nutshell, how that works. I wanted to highlight today a little bit of the collaborative efforts that we have had going on in the state of Alaska, because we have been involved here for the last 18 years. We started work with Alaska in the year 2000. Oh, I guess I'm supposed to do this. Yes. Okay. There we go. Sorry about that. Anyway, we started work with the state of Alaska in Juneau and again began trying to join efforts on what we could do to improve outcomes. In 2005, we hosted a statewide convening on disproportionality. And as you saw in the data slides, disproportionality continues to be, unfortunately, an issue in the state of Alaska, where Alaska Native children come into care more frequently, stay longer, exit slower, that sort of thing. And so we've tried to address that, and through that statewide convening on disproportionality, what followed then is really introducing a curriculum where their focus is on racial and cultural identity, and that has been introduced to the state of Alaska, embedded into their all their training so that all staff really receive training about that as far as how to work across difference, how to understand disproportionality, and what you can do to mitigate some of the effects of that. Another strong partnership that we've had over the year that's been referenced already is Facing Foster Care in Alaska. And I can't say enough about working with that inspiring group of young people and alumni who know firsthand what the issues of foster care are. And we have been supportive of their efforts for many years, and until they became a 501(c). We still partner with them but aren't financially supporting them as much as we were. But I will say that I think Facing Foster Care in Alaska has had quite an impact as far as telling the story and getting people to understand the value of permanency. Just last week, Amanda was telling me about several young adults who were getting adopted, and it's because they have told their story and they understand the need for a permanent relationship. And even when they've aged out of foster care, they still understand the need for that and are tireless advocates about that, so I greatly admire them. I also know that OCS has put some limits as a result of advocacy efforts and of OCS's own realization that kids aging out of foster care is a very poor outcome. And so they've put really strict limits around that. And so many youth are cannot be approved to be aging out of care. So more efforts are going into permanency. And that probably explains some of the data slides that you saw. Permanency values and family finding is something that we've sponsored on a regular basis because, again, searching for family so that youth do have a relationship, whether it be extended family. We've had national experts up here, Kevin Campbell, who's talked with both Facing Foster Care in Alaska and Office of Children's Services about how you can really find at least 30 relatives for a child, if you know, through search engines, through tribes, through lots of avenues. And so there's been a lot of work done there. Permanency roundtables have been held for youth who've been in care for a long period of time. Some permanency summits have been held. And then, in September we will be sponsoring another permanency gathering focusing on guardianship. And in the state of Alaska, guardianship has historically been rather low, even though efforts have been put in place to change the policy so that guardianship is utilized more as a viable permanency option. It still lags a bit behind, and it does appear that guardianship could be utilized much more with relatives and that kind of thing, and so that's going to be a focus of that convening in September. Some other efforts that we've engaged in is you just heard about data advocacy, and Nikki spent some time before with the tribal co-chairs and some of the state leaders in refining some of the data indicators that Alaska uses to track their own data. And that was very successful as far as streamlining data and realizing that you really have to measure to know of how you're making progress.
Ms. Biggs, I want to ask a question just going back up to the last bullet point. Can you describe substantively how guardianship operates is different than adoption for children?
I will do my best. Guardianship really is different than adoption because adoption results in the termination of parental rights, and guardianship generally does not. And so a guardian can be a relative, or it can be a foster parent who assumes guardianship of a child who does have legal authority to consent to all the things that parents consent to, but it does not sever parental rights, and that's particularly important, I think, when you're working in tribal communities, because that's not seen as something that is done by tribes as far as severing of parental rights.
How, just in follow-up that, how functional is a guardianship in terms of allowing for the guardian to be able to make pragmatic day-to-day decisions for the child in their care? I say this as a former foster parent who didn't have, when I was a foster parent, I had almost no rights in terms of functional decision-making for my then foster daughter, and then as soon as I adopted her, all of a sudden I had every right. Guardianship is somewhere in the middle. Can you describe that a little bit?
Yes, Representative Spanholz. I would say it's more toward adoption than it is toward foster care, but you don't have every right as far as it doesn't work exactly like adoption, but really you are the legal guardian, and so you really can make most of the decisions for young people.
Thank you.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Actually,
do you want to follow up, Representative?
I was just thinking about that. Had some experience with this, and that is different from state to state, isn't it?
Through the chair, Representative Johnson, I believe it is, and there's been a recent nationwide study of subsidized guardianship, and it did seem to me that Alaska actually was. Allowed, like, for fictive kin to be guardians and that kind of thing. And so I think Alaska shapes up really pretty well. It's not as restrictive as some other states are, but you're right.
Thank you.
Yes, thank you. I've also served as a member of the Court Improvement Project for the last 8 years. And again, judicial engagement have decided is a really important part to pursue in trying to improve outcomes for children, because the court, of course, has so much say in what happens. And so education of court personnel around the value of permanency, the urgency of permanency, and that kind of thing is part of our goal there. One of the more exciting things that I think we have collaborated with the state on was sponsoring the development of the strategic plan to transform child welfare. And that really, again, kind of set the stage for the signing of the compact that happened in October of 2017. So we were very happy to support those efforts. We realized that there was a lot of negotiations and heavy lifting that the state and the tribes engaged in, and they certainly deserve all the credit for that, but we were happy to be a sponsor of that. Another thing that we have engaged in is a Building Community of Hope project, and what that means is that we believe that to sustain the improvements in foster care, it's not enough to reduce foster care. You have to sustain those efforts, and it's really through engagement of the communities. And so this particular project was undertaken in St. Michael's, a village in which we were really trying to do some prevention. And in a nutshell, what that involved was taking screen-out reports and doing some follow-up with a family worker who could really intervene with the family, build on strengths, get them connected to services with the thought of, you know, if you can prevent kids from coming into the foster care system, it's all for the better for the community and the family, certainly, and the youth. And so that effort was something that we were really pleased with and would like to see more of. Another project that we are currently involved with is the Safe Baby Court project in Palmer that has just recently launched. And, again, that's very exciting as far as focusing on 0 to 3, those young children that try to prevent them from coming into care. I just heard a presentation last week about that, and they are up and running, and They have a modest goal of 20 families, but they are holding monthly court reviews and providing the parents with lots of educational materials and really doing a nice job of trying to bring about permanency for those young children within 12 months. So it's ambitious and exciting, and I think kind of the wave of the future as we talk about more prevention efforts. Recently, last month, in fact, First Lady Walker has taken an interest in the ACEs work that's going on around the state and around the country and the resilience work, and was interested in sponsoring and hosting a convening to bring together all the different entities that are doing ACEs work in the state of Alaska. And I think was pleasantly surprised to find out it's a great deal of work that's going on. It might not be as connected as it could possibly be, and so that was really a goal of that particular convening, was to bring that together. And we're hoping there'll be another follow-up one in the summer or fall, in which the First Lady of the state of Wisconsin, who also is doing quite a bit of work, and would come to Alaska, and again, it would be a nice way to build on the already important work that's going on as far as how to mitigate trauma. And there are very good concrete ways to do that and build on resilience. I think that's my part. Unless you have any further questions, I'd like to turn it over to my Indian Child Welfare colleagues, Anita Finday and Thomas Cody. Thank you.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you. Through the chair, my name is Anita Finday, and I'm the Managing Director for the Indian Child Welfare Program at KC Family Programs. I'm based in Seattle, and with me is Thomas Cody, who's a director for the Indian Child Welfare Program. Mr. Cody is based in Denver. And so we're going to give you a little bit of an overview of the Indian Child Welfare work at KC, and then Mr. Cody will talk about his work with tribes here in Alaska. So I wanted to start out by just giving you a little bit of an overview about the Indian Child Welfare program at KC. And I wanted to mention as background the United States Attorney General's Advisory Committee on American Indian and Alaska Native Children Exposed to Violence. This was work that took place back in 2012 and 2013. And this was a committee that issued a report in November of 2014. And I highlight this report because this committee, in their final report in 2014, focused on Alaska and had one chapter that was devoted to Alaska and to Native Alaska Native children in Alaska, and made several recommendations in Chapter 5. And so in that report, one of the recommendations talked about compacting for services and allowing Alaska Natives to compact for services through the state. So that idea was alive and well in 2013, specifically talking about child welfare. And that idea came from self-governance compacting that tribes had done for health services for more than 20 years. So so I just wanted to highlight that as background, and just say that since that report was issued in 2014, Alaska has moved forward very quickly And we know that compacts were signed last year, and you are in the process of bringing that work forward. I was, and I think working to see that some of these numbers change and come down. So I wanted to provide that as some background. I'm gonna turn this over to Mr. Cody to talk about some of the other goals of Casey's Indian Child Welfare Program.
So Madam Chair, committee members, so my name is Thomas Cody. I'm a member of the Navajo Nation, so I'm Navajo. I grew up in Arizona, but now I live in Denver, Colorado. So a lot of the work that we do is we provide technical assistance to tribes. We work with them on their ICWA financing, capacity building, community engagement. The other thing we do is we do best practices. We try to take, let's take, for example, Clinton Haida. Clinton Haida here, they do an excellent job in financing, working with third-party reimbursements. So we take them to other tribes and say, hey, this is how you could do your child welfare system. The other part is we do tribal gatherings. We bring tribal leaders together to sit down with them, talk with them of what's happening across the nation. We have people on staff that can actually talk with them about, take, for example, Family First. That's what we do. We bring them together, talk with them, update them. The other thing we do is we partner with partners. We work with youth engagement. Like CNAY is one of the major organizations that we work with to engage youth. The other thing we do is tribal state collaboration and relations building between the state and the tribe. So some states don't have good working relationship with the villages or the tribes in their area. So that's we go in and we try to work with both sides to smooth over the relations. The other thing is the national influence. We work to improve the lives of Native American, Alaska Natives across the country. So it's Alaska and the lower 48. So our main work is with 16 child welfare initiatives. We have 16 tribes that we work with across the country, and three of them are here in Alaska. So that's the number one thing we do. The other thing we do is we work with tribal state work. We work with 11 states. Oh, sorry. Let me catch.
There we go.
I thought you were there. So the tribal state work, we work with 11 states across the nation work with them and improving their systems. We do tribal assessments. We do case management. I do code work with them, revising their tribal codes, their Title IV-E programs. We help them develop their Title IV-E programs. The national projects is our tribal leaders, our expert panel. We bring expert panels together to improve the field. Capacity building, capacity development, and Title IV-E summits, that's the project that I work on. I bring tribes, new tribes or that have gotten their Title IV-E development grants. I bring them together and say, this is what tribal Title IV-E is. This is how you could develop it. The National ICWA strategy presentations, our collaborative agreement with NAICJIA. NIDA. The Philanthropy Engagement and Partnership Network, and then we have IPAs in two. We have Fred, who is with the Federal Reserve Bank, and then also Mr. Sheldon Spotter Elk, that's with the BIA. So the next slide just shows you the states that we're in. So those are where we're at. Majority of our work is in the Southwest, and also in the North Dakota, and then also in the Seattle area, and of course, Alaska. So the next slide. So the general, so CORIC is where I do a lot of my work. It's the community of hope is there that Lynn talked about. We do ICWA trainings for them. We do compacting work. We help work with them, recruitment of foster care for foster parents. We do staff training, peer-to-peer, and regional breakouts. Regional breakouts is where we take them to different meetings across the state. The general work up there is just basically I do a lot of my collaborative work with Lynn. She covered that portion, so I won't go into detail. Tenant and Chiefs Conference is basically the thing that stands out there is the 4E maintenance that we work with them on, and then also the recruitment of foster parents. And, of course, we still do the capacity work, compacting work, the staff training, the peer-to-peer, and the regional breakouts. The next one is Clinkit and Haida here in Juneau. We do the compacting work. The thing that we're working with them on there is the data collection and analysis. That's a thing that we started on. We hope they're going to get a new system where they can collect their own data. And then the 4E maintenance, and the rest is just the recruitment staff training. So though that's the work we do here in Alaska, there's other work that we do with other tribes across the country. Any questions?
Representative Sullivan Leonard.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm just looking at the map of the United States, and it's comparable with Alaska, and then you have state of Washington and North Dakota. So no presence then in Oregon or Idaho or California? I'm just curious.
Through the chair, I would say that on the map, the logos that you see are for tribes that we have five-year agreements with.
Okay.
So the foundation has made a commitment to work with those particular tribes. We do a substantial amount of work in California and some work in Idaho with the Nez Perce tribe. We're working with them on a 4E agreement with the state. Not much work in Oregon. So this map does not reflect all of our work.
Okay.
It reflects the 16 tribes that we have five-year agreements with.
So one of the...
Thank you. Yeah. Oh, go ahead.
Madam Chair. So one of the projects that we've just wrapped up is the Eastern Band of Cherokees, mm-hmm. which is back east. Mm-hmm. The other one we are working with is Menominee mm-hmm. in Wisconsin, and then the Mashpee tribe
mm-hmm.
right outside of Boston.
Right, very good. Thanks.
So we have these little projects that we do, but to make the majority of them that are here are the 16 agreements that we have.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you. The final topic that we wanted to discuss are some new federal funding opportunities that have just become available for states and tribes across the country. And this is based on the Family First Prevention Services Act, which was signed into law in February, just this past February. It's truly historic legislation, and it represents the culmination of discussion for many years with members of Congress and their staff, and with state leaders and jurisdictional leaders who have been educating Congress about the need for safe reduction of foster care as well as other issues related to the child welfare system. This was bipartisan legislation and bicameral. It was had very strong support in both chambers of commerce of Congress and moved ahead over many years, actually, but it's just been enacted, so it's all very new. We're waiting for regulations to be issued by the Federal Children's Bureau, which are due in October 1st of 2018. We will have a lot more detail, but the legislation was actually quite extensive and detailed itself. just an overview. One of the options, I don't think we're going to have time to really go through in detail all the provisions of Family First, but we wanted to provide this information for the record and for your reference later, and we would be glad to come back and provide more information and discussion at another time. But one of the main provisions that Alaska is very well positioned to take advantage of is new funding for prevention activities. You heard Thomas mention 4E, and Title 4E of the Social Security Act provides for the primary funding, dedicated child welfare federal funding source. It's about $7 billion in federal funds, and it in the past has been limited to maintenance, so room and board, foster care maintenance, and other payments for children in foster care or who exit from foster care to adoption or to legal guardianship. One of the very significant provisions of the Family First Act was that for the first time it allows states and tribes to claim federal reimbursement for certain services to prevent the need for foster care. So this has been something that states and jurisdictions have for many years been very concerned about, that the federal investment has been limited once children enter foster care. There has been very little federal funding available for states to try to prevent the need for foster care or to provide child protective services, for example, so anything outside of the foster care and adoption and guardianship systems. So Title IV-E has now been provided as an option for states to provide certain evidence-based prevention services for children at imminent risk of placement in foster care and their parents or kinship caregivers, as well as pregnant and parenting youth in foster care. And at this point, we don't have a lot of information about what the federal definition of imminent risk will be. In some states, the way they have claimed Title IV-E funding probably positions them a little bit better to have a definition already developed, but the federal regulations will help to clarify exactly what that is, and we should know fairly soon. Eligible services are specifically defined in the legislation, and they are mental health and substance abuse prevention and treatment services, as well as in-home parenting skills services. These services can be provided for up to 12 months, but there is no limit on how many times a child and family can receive the prevention services. So they might be eligible for 12 months, and then, 12 months later, a child would again be, there might be a report or another circumstance that would indicate that a child is again at imminent risk of foster care, and those 12 more months of services could be provided. One of the really significant things about this legislation is that for all Title IV-E services in the past, foster care, adoption assistance, and guardianship assistance, it's been based on income eligibility requirements of the child's family of origin. And the income eligibility requirements are actually based on 1996 AFDC standards. So they're very old. They're very outdated. The cost of living has increased dramatically since 1996. So over time, fewer and fewer children have been eligible for federal reimbursement for foster care or adoption assistance or guardianship. So one of the really significant aspects of this bill is that these prevention services are not based on income eligibility. It's not tied to the family's income. These federal reimbursement for these services will begin October 1st, 2019, so it's very quickly approaching us, especially as you think about the state fiscal year and your state budget. It's something, it's a very new opportunity, but it is something that states and tribes will have an opportunity to act on quickly. As I mentioned, this legislation, we call it delinking from AFDC, so it no longer requires that income eligibility. Another requirement is that the funds cannot supplant existing state funding for prevention services or actually use of federal funding for these same services. There is a maintenance of effort requirement, and that will be set at fiscal year 2014 spending levels for those same services for candidates for foster care. So all of that we are expecting to be clarified and really detailed with when the federal regs are issued. That's a really significant opportunity for Alaska, we feel, because as you saw in the outcomes that were in the data, Alaska's entry rate into foster care is much higher than many other states. However, as you also saw, Alaska makes very low use of congregate care. There are some provisions in the bill that ensure the appropriate placement in foster care. In addition to the Title IV-E requirements, which I'll talk about a little bit more, the Act provides $8 million in grants for states to support recruitment and retention of high-quality foster parents. Those will be targeted at states that have a lot of challenges in recruiting foster parents and have not utilized those family foster homes as much as others. So whether that money would be appropriate for Alaska, you know, we will see when the regs are issued.
We have a question from Representative Sullivan Leonard.
Thank you, through the chair. Just looking at the $8 million that is being proposed for a grant for the state of Alaska, does that require a state of Alaska match then for that, or is it just a grant?
Yeah, through the chair, that is $8 million for the whole country.
Oh.
So it's actually going to be not a lot of money, and it will be targeted to those states and jurisdictions where there has been lower utilization of family foster care and higher utilization of congregate care. So Alaska is probably not very well positioned for that, and it probably will not be a lot of money per grant.
So you're just teasing us. I see. Yeah, thank you. I appreciate it.
Thank you. Some of the significant provisions of the Act related to placement are that it makes changes to what types of out-of-home placements will be eligible for the Title IV-E reimbursement, and that will start October 1st, 2019. The states, we've said, this is not probably an issue of great concern to Alaska because most of your foster care is provided in family settings, but for some states who use a lot of congregate care, if they want to delay this requirement, this provision for 2 years, they can do that, but it will also delay their ability to access that prevention funding. So these are the requirements. This is based on those requirements for changing family, the use of foster care. So after 2 weeks in care, moving forward, starting in 2019, Title IV-E can be used to support only these types of placements that you see listed. Family foster care, that means no more than six children in foster care. Facilities for pregnant and parenting youth, supervised independent living for youth, older youth, and specialized placements for youth who are victims of sex trafficking. Also, this is a rather significant change. 4E will be able to be used for family-based residential treatment facilities for substance abuse. That's been a big barrier. So now jurisdictions and tribes will be able to use 4E for keeping families together even when a parent needs residential treatment for substance abuse. So one of the big provisions is that other congregate care settings, in order to claim reimbursement after 2 weeks in care, will have to be quality residential treatment programs. They will have to meet certain criteria as defined in the Act and as will also be further clarified in regulation. Mm-hmm. So for congregate care, there will be no time limits on how long a child can be placed in one of these facilities and receive federal reimbursement, but they will have to have an assessment that shows that they require that type of residential treatment, mm-hmm. And that the program will have to have a trauma-informed model. They will have to have a registered or licensed nurse or other licensed clinical staff on site. Mm-hmm. And they will need to integrate really a family approach. They will need to conduct outreach and engagement of the child's family as part of their treatment plan.
Yeah, I have a question about this, particularly as it relates to the family-based residential treatment in the state of Alaska. We're in the process of changing the way we pay for addiction treatment, in particular, mm-hmm. moving from a grant-based model to a Medicaid sort of billing model. But when you're talking about residential or family-based residential treatment, then you have additional costs. How's that funding structured? How does it pay for treatment?
Yes, Madam Chair. Medicaid is often used to pay for the parents' residential treatment,
right.
But the children, the parent and the child is normally typically placed in foster care while the parent is receiving treatment. Mm-hmm. So, there is evidence that that creates trauma for the child, further trauma for the child. Mm-hmm. They then become part of the foster care system. Their outcomes, stability, the well-being, the safety for the child is impacted. So what will be possible moving forward will be to use the Title IV-E treatment for the child's stay mm-hmm. with the parent mm-hmm. in the residential treatment facility. Mm-hmm. And, states and jurisdictions can continue to use Medicaid for many of those components.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
But in the past, because the child is not covered and their care right. and those costs,
yeah.
Have really been a barrier to the expansion of these kind of family-based treatment programs,
yeah.
although evidence shows that they are very effective, more effective than when a parent receives treatment on their own in a separate, program and facility, and then the family needs to be reunited.
Right.
That produces a lot of challenges for the family as a whole.
Yeah, I would add that in addition to reducing trauma of, removing a child from their parent, it probably also really it does improve outcomes for the parent in treatment as well, because when you take somebody out of their regular life responsibilities for treatment, and they can find some recovery in that scenario, but when you reintroduce the stresses of being a parent, which is just a real a real life scenario, sometimes it's hard to apply that learning to the parenting, and so you sort of have this more integrated approach if people can go through treatment mm-hmm. with their child, and they can face the bumps that come along with having a challenging 3-year-old, for example, or kids that are angry maybe about something.
Yeah,
yeah,
yeah.
They can yeah have better outcomes. That's great.
Also, the most of the programs that are high quality and evidence-based programs that have been shown to be effective work very much with the child and with the parent to do parent training as part of the program, to do a lot of enrichment and trauma-based interventions with the child. So they are really clinical treatment programs for both parents and children. So that's one of a major sort of new opportunity of this legislation, and one that you might want to consider. Another provision is that well, here's some more information about placement in the family-based treatment facilities. They will have to be licensed. It will be limited to 12 months, but no income eligibility is required. So that's a huge benefit as well. So families who may not be eligible for Medicaid would still be eligible to use the Title IV-E funding. I should say with all of these Title IV-E possibilities for foster care prevention services and family-based treatment and some of the other services that you'll see, that's a federal match. States do have to contribute. Alaska's match rate is 50%, so for every dollar that Alaska spends, it can match that in federal Title IV-E funding. However, the administrative costs associated are also included. States claim a lot of federal funding for their administrative cost of these Title IV-E programs, and training costs are reimbursed at 75%. There's another provision that provides small grants, $5 million, and new grants to states to develop, to upgrade their electronic data systems for placement of children across state lines, so interstate placement. And it does require that states have an electronic interstate case management, case processing system by October 2027, so it's 9 years to develop that. Here are some additional provisions. One that you might be interested in is support for evidence-based kinship navigator programs. Federal reimbursement at 50% will be available for those. Again, no requirement for income eligibility for kin caregivers to be eligible for those programs. So that's it's an evidence-based program that has been shown to provide important supports for kin caregivers to prevent the disruption of those placements, to provide the kind of assistance in helping caregivers navigate the services that are available and in the community, and helping them to learn how to access those. And there are some great models that we can show you or provide more information for. One of the interesting provisions is that the Federal Children's Bureau will be identifying model foster care licensing standards, and that's something that's going to be developed. I don't have the time frame here, but in the next few years is a fairly quick requirement, and then states will need to identify how they will use those licensing standards. They're not required to implement them necessarily, but they will have to report how they are using them and how they are not, and we expect more clarification of that as the regs are issued.
Question from Representative Johnston.
I think you kind of answered my question through the chair, but you're waiting to see. We don't know if it's something we're going to need a waiver for or
through the chair. No, it's right now for kinship, approval of kinship families, the state can provide a case-by-case waiver of licensing standards that are not related to safety in order to license kinship caregivers. We don't expect that to change, but there's no uniform system across the country for licensing foster care, family foster care. Mm-hmm. And there has been a move to do that. So this would be something that the Children's Bureau will be developing with a lot of input.
Hard to know. Yeah, Representative Zolkowski.
I'm two slides back on the Title IV-E for the keeping families together during substance use treatment. I'd be curious to follow up with you after your presentation today on what models like that might look like. We've been having a lot of conversations at the statewide level about substance use and abuse, and we know that there are not enough beds, not just in urban Alaska, but also in rural Alaska, and so I would be interested to find out more on models that have worked in other states for family residential treatment programs and what those funding models look like that make them sustainable, because we see that as a critical component for healthy families in all of our communities. So that's been kind of percolating, so I'd love to follow up with you after today to talk about that further.
Through the chair, we would be glad to provide information and to pull together information, especially about programs in rural areas, for example. There are a lot of resources that are being developed, and family-based treatment facilities have been evaluated, but this legislation will definitely, you know, encourage their use and the evaluation of their effectiveness.
So one more follow-up. I'm particularly interested because in my home community, in my district, they just recently opened a substance abuse component. There's been alcohol treatment, but there's a new opioid treatment program element associated with that particular facility. And so we know that that's one of the first, if not the first, rural-based opioid treatment program in the state. And so I'd be curious, as we've talked about integrating different integrating models of care and having family components, I'm just interested in learning more.
Through the chair, thank you very much for your interest. We'd be glad to provide more information. It's opioid use is such a huge issue across the country. If you sort of think back to our first slide, you know, we have been very committed to reducing the number of children in foster care by half by the year 2020, and we're very much on track to do that until about 2012. And the opioid epidemic is has been a big factor in the increase in numbers of children in foster care in the last, you know, 5 or 6 years. So it's something that we too are very interested in learning how to address and how to treat and how to the impact on children and families. So,
cool.
Thank you for your interest. There are some other provisions of the Act that I don't think we need to go through in a lot of detail, but I wanted you to have this information. In addition to the new ability to use Title IV-E for prevention of foster care, it reauthorized a number of programs. So, for example, there is an adoption legal guardianship incentive program where states receive sort of a bonus based on the rate of their increase in use of adoption and guardianship, and that's been reauthorized. The way that the legislation is paid for is based on sort of delaying some of the delinking that had been planned for this income eligibility standard for children. In the federal government was in the process of doing away with those requirements very slowly and incrementally, starting with older children in adoption assistance and sort of then phasing it down. So the way that they're paying for the expansion to prevention services is delaying that delink for children, young children, for I think it's another 6 years beyond what had been planned. So that's kind of the cost, the way they're offsetting the cost of the bill. The bill reauthorized a number of programs that had expired or were set to expire, including the Court Improvement Program, which has been very important here in Alaska. Mm-hmm. And it some other programs like the Independent Living Program and other supports. I just wanted to briefly mention an older piece of federal legislation, and it relates also to the discussion you had about guardianship earlier. This legislation was in authorized in 2008, I'm sorry, by the Federal Fostering Connections Act. And it allowed this use of this Title IV-E funding for guardianship assistance in in addition to foster care payments and adoption assistance payments. Although it's been 10 years and many states have begun implementation, it's something that has been slow to really spread. And so I just wanted to bring it to your attention. It is another way to move children to permanency through guardianship. It provides support for guardians. And I also wanted to address the question earlier about the difference in guardianship mm-hmm. and adoption and in foster care. Guardianship does not require termination of parental rights. It is much more culturally acceptable and appropriate for many many cultures, including Alaska Native and Native American. And it does allow the guardian to make decisions about a child's educational treatment, medical treatment, day-to-day care. Most decisions except for consent to adoption and consent to marriage. And so it's very different from foster care. It provides where the state retains the authority and the responsibility for making many of those decisions, mm-hmm. and it allows the guardian to make those decisions instead.
Yeah, I just want to explore that a little bit more with guardianship instead of adoption. Does that have any impact on subsidies for support of the child?
No, it's well, with this extension of Title IV-E for guardianship, mm-hmm. The federal subsidy is available mm-hmm. for guardians who have who are a relative as defined by the state, and the feds leave it up to the states to define what that means. Mm-hmm. So many states include fictive kin mm-hmm. in their definition. People who have a close mm-hmm. and significant emotional relationship with the child, as well as relationship by blood or adoption or marriage. Mm-hmm. And then the guardian, to receive the federal reimbursement, mm-hmm. the guardian must be the child's licensed foster parent for at least 6 months mm-hmm. prior to obtaining legal permanent guardianship through the court.
I think that that one of the important pieces, this is completely anecdotal, but I've shared that my daughter has biological siblings who were not adopted, and it's my observation that there are some cases that where children who are in long-term foster placements are not adopted or are not adopted because that doesn't seem to be practical for one reason or another, but that guardianship hasn't been understood as an option, maybe in part because of a fear of losing the financial support for the child. When you bring additional children into your family, there is a financial element of that. You have to have extra rooms in your house, and you know, you have to be able to feed, you know, you have to feed extra children and all of those things, and there can be a perception that those subsidies would go away, and that may be an important piece of communicating you know, the value and the role that a guardianship may play. Now that's entirely anecdotal, but
Chair,
important factor.
I think you're absolutely right. And one of the things that we have learned is that it's very important to provide accurate and complete information for foster parents, for kin, about what their options are. Mm-hmm. And we hear from kin quite often that they don't feel like they have that information. Maybe it's provided initially when they you know, accept responsibility for a child whose parent is not available or not able to care for them, but it's not raised again. Mm-hmm. And ideally, actually, a federal legislation requires that states make diligent efforts to find and engage kin. And so we, from the experiences of states, it's not just a one-time outreach to kin that needs to happen, but it needs to be ongoing, it needs to be repeated, and what they tell us is that they really need accurate information about the different options and mm-hmm. how they compare. And also to understand the legal system enough to be able to make those decisions in an informed way.
Yeah, absolutely. I think one of the things that sometimes
professionals in the field forget is that lay people who are, you know, taking in, you know, who take in children really don't understand the details of a very, very complicated child welfare system and are often trying to navigate, you know, dealing with children that are, you know, that are have experienced trauma and challenges along the way. And so we need to lay out all of the information as transparently and proactively and maybe a few times along the way so that they understand what their assets are, and then it'll make it easier for foster parents and prospective guardians and prospective adoptive parents to be able to take those next steps in support of the child that they grow to love.
Right. Mm-hmm. Chair Sponholz, we would agree completely. And in addition, you know, the federal requirement requires that children, older children, be consulted about the decision as well, and their wishes be considered. Mm-hmm. And that reunification adoption must be ruled out for guardianship. So the state agency or the tribe has to make efforts to reunify the family before they go immediately to guardianship. Mm-hmm. And another sort of difference in adoption is the birth parent can come back and petition the court for guardianship. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't happen often, but that is a possibility. Mm-hmm. But for most families where kin, where they accept guardianship, they don't want to destroy their family by terminating the
parental rights.
Often these are grandparents. Mm-hmm. So they are very interested in maintaining the integrity of their family, and you know, they have there's a lot of conflict around terminating the rights, their connection with their children. And one of the another complicating factor is that often guardianship petitions are filed in probate court rather than dependency court. So that can be very confusing for guardians, for or kin who are interested in becoming guardians. And one of the provisions of the Fostering Connections Act and the Guardianship Assistance Program is not only will Title IV-E provide funds for maintenance payments for guardians caring for, you know, children, mm-hmm. but also for startup costs. Mm-hmm. They will reimburse for up to $2,000 in startup costs, which could be legal expenses that the potential guardian faces, or it could be things like preparing their home for a child who, you know, they were not anticipating they would be caring for, mm-hmm. Or anything related to those initial non-recurring costs. Mm-hmm. Also, the Act provides, again, for 75% reimbursement for training of kin caregivers and guardians, as well as attorneys for all parties involved. And, you know, so there are definitely some opportunities for states to leverage this Title IV-E funding. Mm-hmm. And frankly, one of the biggest barriers has been the licensing. In many jurisdictions, the kinship caregivers don't want to have to go through the licensing requirements, mm-hmm. And become licensed foster parents. Mm-hmm. But this legislation, again, allowed states to waive on a case-by-case basis mm-hmm. non-safety licensing requirements. And, you know, I think that's been one of the challenges for implementation is states haven't really, in many cases, geared up to do that. Mm-hmm. And guardians have not been aware that that's a possibility. So, again, having complete, accurate information up front and throughout the process is really critical. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So that completes our presentation. We, you know, welcome any further questions or comments. Or we want to, KC Family Programs would look forward to being a resource for you on child welfare issues. We, as I said, we our public policy team works with policymakers at the federal and state local level throughout the country, and we are eager to respond to your questions or provide you with information, examples, connect you with legislators in other states, for example, or whatever makes sense for you in helping you to do your jobs.
Well, thank you very much to all of you for taking so much time for flying to Alaska. We always love to have visitors for sharing the data and the context of the Alaska of our Alaska situation as it compares to some of our some of the other states and some of the other rest of the country. I appreciate that. I know that many of us will be following up with you for specific information and for some technical assistance. For the committee, next Tuesday we're going to be hearing from the Department of Health and Social Services and some community members on Alaska Psychiatric Institute. There will be representatives of employees and patient advocates that will participate as well. On Thursday, we'll be hearing a presentation on the Department of Health and Social Services epidemiology section's report on the health impacts of climate change. And then with that, it is 4:44, and this hearing of the House Social Services Committee is adjourned.